Radio with over 250 guests and still going strong in their 12th year of weekly broadcasting, the International Taz and Paula Show brings to you expansive, engaging, and groundbreaking intensity on radio and now on the internet airwaves today. Listen live every Thursday or visit Embracing Mother Earth's archives, exclusive articles, ask questions, and receive actual answers from guests anytime at TazandPaulaShow.com. Taz and Paula's special guests are experts coming from all walks of life, energizing our lives with a passion that inspires and teaches us with each of their compelling personal life journeys, with roots from ancient wisdom and bridging it with modern science. We hope today's show touches the wisdom of your heart. And now, Taz and Paula.
Well, happy Halloween is bobbing just around the corner. So good afternoon to all of our listeners. Our guest today, William J. Hull, shares a true terrifying poltergeist story. What may be the most notorious and most terrifying poltergeist haunting of recent decades, the Bridgeport poltergeist was seen and heard by thousands of people on one unforgettable day in 1974. And one of the local youngsters, William J. Hull, remembers viewing it on TV when he was 10 years old. William Hull grew up to become a magician and a well-known investigator of the paranormal and the unexplained, writing a syndicated column on those subjects for many years in Connecticut newspapers. And today, Paula, our journalist, William, relays the details for this terrifying poltergeist story. You are now listening to the International Taz and Paula Show. I'm Taz.
And I'm Paula. Well, Taz, William has ushered in from his past never-before-reported interviews of the first responders and other witnesses and previously unrevealed documents and reports in his new book, The World's Most Haunted House, The True Story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Linley Street. This book exposes those gnarly feelings of the Linley Street haunting brought to life from the inside out. And with an in-depth investigation encompassing policemen, firefighters, and others, exposing the ups and downs of things that go bumpity-bump in the night.
Paula, in real life, this is not one of my most favorite things to do. I know you love Halloween, right? But
yes.
For me, Halloween was a scary thing for me always. I'm not really sure where that came from. I just didn't like to go out and walk the streets in the dark for trick-or-treating ever. William Hull, we are honored to share you and your book with our listeners. Welcome.
Well, we're going to call you Bill, if that's okay. Hold on. I think he's got turned off. Hi, Bill. Welcome to our show.
Hi. I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Now, when did you start? It sounds like it might have been when you were a kid, but when did you start being interested in the paranormal?
Oh, yes, it was very young. You know, I grew up on In Search Of, and that's incredible for us older folks, not old folks, but older folks. I was interested. You know, I started doing magic, very poorly, but, you know, at age 7. So I was always fascinated from there on in with anything like this, whether it was, you know, UFOs or haunted houses or any of that kind of thing. And later on, of course, becoming much more skeptical about it. But I always had an open mind. You know, I always held an open mind to it. And I did research it more, I think, than most of us do, you know, as you guys do, because, you know, and the listeners, because we're the people who are, you know, look deeper than just saying, I don't believe it. You know, we tend to say, I don't know if it's true or not. Let me order that government document, or let me try to research further and to dig a little bit deeper before, you know, believing or dismissing something. So, but I've been interested in for many years, and then in the 90s did a newspaper column where I would do different articles every month on different things, whether it's fortune telling, the pyramids, UFOs, haunted houses, things like that.
When you were 10, Bill, and you were sitting before the TV and you saw this happening, what was your immediate thought?
I thought it was really cool. And I asked my dad, you know, Dad, you know, is this real? And he, of course, he said no. And, you know, life went on, but that was, you know, that's my dad. Happy to say he's a little bit more open now. I think the evidence is finally getting to him. But, but at that time he's like, oh, no, it's, you know, it's just a hoax, and that was it. And, you know, as most people on the outside would have responded, except for those who are a little bit closer to the details or who took more of an interest other than the regular cursory interest that somebody watching the news would have gotten out of it. But so I never really knew much what to think of it, but I was always fascinated by it.
When you on TV, did you actually see furniture being thrown around?
No, they didn't show anything like that. It was mostly, as I can remember, and you know, I don't like to go by my 10-year-old memory, but I remember people talking outside the house is the only memory I have of it, and I can't tell you if that's a completely accurate memory. But from all my research, I can tell you that you know, there were some interviews inside and outside of the house, but nothing was caught on camera. There actually were reporters in the house that had cameras, but more or less were kind of happened too fast, or they were more or less caught in the moment. It was difficult to remain outside of the story when they ended up finding out that they were part of it, you know, in the middle of it.
Wow. How long did this really last? Oops, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, answer it.
I was going to say, how long did this period last when this was going forward? Was it a half a day, a day, or you know?
Weeks?
Yeah. How long?
Yeah. Well, the overall, from the very start of any phenomena to the end, it would be from 1968 to 1975. But if we look at the ultimate height of the activity, occurred over the weekend in November 1974. Friday night to about Tuesday morning was really the real heavy periods. And that was during the period where it leaked out to the public and soon the media and then, you know, the world from there was because the police were there on Sunday. And that's Sunday and Monday were the two big days that gather the crowds and the dogs and paddy wagons and police protection and traffic stopping and all the rest of it as the story hit the AP wire and traveled, you know, around the world.
I bet the family, I felt sorry for the family because I'm sure they got criticism from the outside.
Oh, it was brutal, absolutely brutal. At work for Jerry, the father, and he was a maintenance man at Harvey Hubbell factory in Bridgeport at the time. So there was ridicule from people and, you know, both, you know, just regular people. And there was a lot of criticism, you know, at work. People really made fun of him to no end at work. And then people would vandalize their car and, you know, pull clothes off the clothesline and, you know, throw rocks at the house and just all that kind of horrible things that people do. And other people were very supportive, you know, maintaining a vigil outside the house. Some people prayed. The neighbors were extremely supportive because they heard the screams and, you know, and they knew it was a real situation. And some of them knew other people on the same street that were having problems, kind of like an overflow, you know, from the house. So they would bring over big goods and things to help the family out like you would do in the time of need, you know, whether it's a funeral or, you know, whatever the situation was. Because, you know, a lot of those people, of course, knew them, and they knew that this was not fake. They knew that they were suffering because they knew the family before all of this. So,
well, some people blamed they had an adopted daughter, and some people blamed the adopted daughter for being the creator of all of this.
Yeah, and that was the the hoax story, the story to get rid of the crowds. And it was also the very first thing that you would suspect in a case like this. There are cases where something like this will happen and an outsider will come and very quickly see through it, you know, because a child can fool their parents, but, you know, when an outsider comes in, it's usually pretty easy to notice that things are only happening when the child's around and things like that. Police will, you know, when they show up, they'll naturally immediately suspect the child. And, you know, and that happened at this case, too, until, you know, the officers really saw phenomena for themselves. You know, when a 300-pound refrigerator floats, you know, you can't blame it on the child anymore, or when there's phenomena happening in every room, you know. So there was no question it wasn't her, but to the public, it's a very easy sell. You know, our attention span is like that of a gnat. So, you know, if police officers are, and firefighters and priests, and they're all being interviewed in the newspaper saying about all these things that happened, you know, 2 days later, you can easily just say, oh, no, it was the girl, and, you know, everybody goes home. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, you know, look at Roswell, same kind of thing, right? Something out of this world. No, it's not. It's just a plastic weather balloon. You know, a major couldn't tell the difference. You know, we'll fly it in a special plane, even though it's just a pile of junk. We'll put it in this nice special plane and fly it off. You know, and the public says, okay, and everybody moves on. It's just it's just really kind of funny. But, you know, that's the way these things are. You don't really need to prove a hoax story. And, you know, in the police department's defense, this thing just kept getting bigger and bigger. You know, the longer this thing was going on without an explanation, the more people were arriving and from farther away. So, you know, it was really a hazardous situation, and the police knew it. And the superintendent wanted his city back. It was tying up police resources. I mean, three guys even trying to burn the house down while the family was inside. So,
oh my God.
I mean, this was, you know, I mean, what other way to get rid of evil spirits than to burn humans inside a house, you know? But, you know, that's, so, you know, the way crowds are, it's just crazy. You know, the traffic and, you know, and that of course, increases the amount of accidents you're going to have. I mean, this thing was just a real crazy scene, and it wasn't making the superintendent look good. He wanted his city back. He knew that there was no explanation, but what are you going to do, tell people there's no explanation and just have the crowds get more out of control? Because even with barricades and dogs and paddywhack and things like that, it's still, you know, a nightmare for the police department. So when they saw Marcy, two guys had never been in the house before on Tuesday morning saw Marcy, you know, kick a TV. And that was the start of, oh, look, I saw you kick a TV. And, you know, you must have made the cat talk, which was another you know, phenomena that was going on. The cat didn't talk, but there was audio phenomena. And Marcy used to pretend to make her little kitten talk. But, you know, she was very lonely and shy and everything, and she used to say that was her only friend. And, you know, it didn't fool anybody, but because she did that, when they asked her, she said, oh, yeah, I make Sam talk. And, you know, and then, of course, everything got blamed on her. You know, things she couldn't have possibly done. A lot of phenomena happened when she wasn't even in the house. But again, nobody's really looking at details. And, you know, somebody asked me, well, didn't the inspector, you know, look into the details? And it's like, well, no, he didn't have to. He had the details. You know, he wasn't trying to figure out whether it was a hoax or not. He knew it wasn't a hoax. You know, this was necessary to get rid of the crowds, and that's been well proven by the witnesses involved, including the captain. I mean, they all knew it, and they all said it behind the scenes that, we did the best we could with what was presented to us. We had to shut this thing down for the family's sake, too, although Jerry said he really wished they blamed him and not poor Marcy, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I read somewhere that she was adopted out from a large family, and that made people kind of question, why did the other family want to adopt her out? I mean, that was one of the questions up in the air.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we don't know too much about that family. And, you know, so some people hypothesize, was the poltergeist originally, with that family? Were they scared of her, or was it just too much to handle? It was said they tied her to a chair. We don't know the context of that. We know it's not good, but is it because there's too many children, or was it abuse? Or, we just really don't have a lot of information on that, especially with the way adoptions were back then. So unfortunately, that remains one of the things on the possibility list. But we do know that the activity, although very, very small, started shortly after Marcy was adopted. So I don't think Marcy caused it, but we do know that she was obviously, no matter what theory anybody has on what a poltergeist is, everybody agrees Marcy was at the center of it anyhow.
Is she still alive,
That'll leave for the book, because I have gotten in trouble for giving that. Some people say I gave it away. It's a spoiler, alert. But we do trace that in the book for you. That's probably the only question I won't answer.
Okay.
You wouldn't believe the backlash over, the spoiler alert, but,
Was this strictly a poltergeist only, or were there other kinds of forms of entities involved?
Well, and that's really the question of how, we define a poltergeist. So for those who believe it's just psychokinesis, I would say that's not the case, but I don't really believe that, poltergeist is psychokinesis. I mean, I could be wrong. Again, these are all theories, and I say this all the time, that, I don't want to fight anybody on their theory, because I'm happy that we're just discussing it. I think us people who look into these things need to stick together. But, I do, because, some people get into these big fights over, no, it's a demon, no, it's an entity, no, it's psychokinesis, no, it, you're wrong, you're stupid. It's like, well, it's unknown. And I think we need to kind of, even if you believe something completely different, I think this is the area of all that we should be happy that we're at least acknowledging it and, looking for answers. But with this, it definitely, to me, when you look at the indicators of these, what I would call parasites or entities, they definitely feed on some sort of trouble, that negative energy, and Marcy was the lonely, introverted, kept to herself, was now in a strange land and picked on at school, and then finally got beat up at school and was home from school with her overbearing parents, because they had a smaller child who died when he was 6 with cerebral palsy, couldn't walk or talk. So they have this unhealthy parenting style with Marcy, kind of treating her like they did Jerry Jr., their little boy who died, and they were afraid Marcy was going to die. So
yeah.
it was all of that, and now she's stuck at home for 6 weeks with the overbearing mother, who's, you can't go across the street, you'll get killed, kind of, philosophy. And so this did all pique the activity, but there were entities involved. So in my mind, I wouldn't think that, a psychokinesis would not only have entities, but usually if one thinks to look, that there are other houses that are affected. It's never just, one house. well, I don't want to say never. I should never say never. And there's different kinds of hauntings, obviously. But in a case like this, it looks like when the door opens, you know, whatever door you believe, whether it's dimensional, whether it's hell, whether it's a multi-universe, which I prefer the quantum physics kind of explanation. But, you know, jury's out on all of that. But whatever opens tends to bring through just more than one species or type or whatever, and you find that there's other houses that are impacted also by different entities in different ways, and we found that on Lindley Street also. So I do think that's one of the common indicators. The other thing is we usually find a lake or a stream nearby. In this case, there was an underwater spring under the house. And then you know, Bridgeport was known for, you know, the sandy soils and high water tables, which seems to be another commonality. Although, you know, this would fall into basically anybody's theory. They're just kind of, you know, things that coincide. But so I don't think it was Marcy's kind of unconscious frustration. I do think that there definitely is some sort of negative relationship, you know, between the entities and Marcy, that they feed off that they appear like they know how to push buttons. I hesitate to call them evil, though, because I don't think we know enough. You know, we're good at we're very guilty of giving human motivations to things that are not necessarily human, and I'm guilty of it too. You know, if I mow the lawn and gnats attack me, I think I disrupted their home and they're attacking me to save their home. You know, because that's a human motivation. It doesn't occur to me that that's not why they're coming after me. They're coming after me because they're attracted, yeah. Mm-hmm. And not because it's minty fresh, but because of the chemicals I release. But you know, so we apply a lot of human motivations to these things, but I don't like to call them evil because I don't know. I mean, the people outside that tried to burn down the house, were they evil? I don't think so. They were stupid. They were scared, but I wouldn't call them
scared.
You know, yeah, I wouldn't call them evil because,
you know,
these things may not have asked to be here, or they may have. I'm not saying that they're positive and they're lovely and, you know, no, there are definitely some very negative things that they do. But I wouldn't label them evil because, you know, maybe neutral, maybe negative. We're seeing the worst side of them, but we really don't know, I think, enough. And we do know that there's good things that come through also. Some would call them angels. Some would just call them, you know, good spirits or, you know, whatever we name them. To me, you know, I'd rather name them based on behavior rather than specifically labeling exactly this is Fred or, you know, because it's tough to get to that level of preciseness in knowing exactly what these things are. But, you know, these
They were just lifting up things and moving things. So, to them, I mean, it was just, you know, I mean, probably an easy trick. Who knows? You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, and some of that, some of it, I think, you know, some of it was definitely them because it was very intentional. You know, so if an entity picks up and throws Marcy across the room, that's like, we don't even know, but we would assume that that's a negative and an intentional act. You know.
Right.
Did they actually pick her up and throw her across the room?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, poor thing.
Yeah.
Well,
but,
no wonder,
you know,
the neighbors got scared. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, who wants that to come into their home, too? I mean, it's kind of like, wow.
Well, see, that's a good point. That's why I try to think broader that I know. I try to always ask myself, okay, let's assume you know less and it's not what you think. What could it be? And, you know, the refrigerator floating, I don't think an entity did that. I think that's an energy reaction, you know, from the upset and the electromagnetic fields, you know. I don't think that that's something that somebody specifically did. I think that's, and, you know, Paul Eno, I steal this from him, but he gives a great example. If you have a pile of papers on a desk, and you run by the desk, you've upset the papers, but it wasn't an intentional act. It was by the energy let off by you, you know, running close to the papers. You know, you blew them up and they, you know, they blow all over the place. And I think a lot of the things that we see in these cases are not intentional, and other things are intentional. But the fridge floating, I would venture to say that that was not like an intentional thing, that that was part of the energies of the two worlds or dimensions, or like I said, you know, use whatever word makes you happy, intersecting or, you know, or having been opened, or like I said, you know, use whatever term, you know, you prefer. But to me, I don't, you know, as one of the newspaper reporters told me, he said, I don't believe it's a demon that moved a toy boat 4 inches to the left. And, well, I mean, in that case, I would say the movement of that particular object was not an intentional act. I think that was caused by this mix of energies, whereas other things, like I said, an entity, you know, appearing, or an entity, you know, picking up the girl or flipping a chair while she's in it, that may be, you know, those are more kind of intentional things, things that are directed specifically towards people. Another example was a Christmas tree. The ornaments, they came home one day, the Christmas tree ornaments were underneath the tree in a neat little pile. So that's freaky, you know. That would be, you know, more, you know, intentional, you know what I mean?
Did they bring in a minister or a priest?
What happened was, you know, the escalation of this was the off-duty police officer from across the street, who's a friend and a neighbor, came first. He didn't know what to do, so he called for backup. More police came. They saw things, and they didn't know what to do, so they called the fire department. They came. Everything with the house is fine, so they didn't know what to do. So a fireman calls up the department chaplain. And, you know, he says, hey, Father, I'm not drunk, but this is what's going on here. and they go to get him. And that was Father Doyle, for those that are local that may know him. And he came and said, there's, you know, evil presence here, and he had trouble breathing. And he tried to make a cheer go back, but Marcy was flying back in several times very, very quickly. In fact, while the police officers were actually talking to her, this happened. So there was just a, you know, a house full of witnesses. But so he was going to try to get an exorcism done. You know, that never happened. Of course, then later on, even that day, the crowd started forming and word started getting out. And once this thing got massive, you know, that was over. And then a neighbor knew Ed and Lorraine Warren because she saw them speak, and she called them up, and they came with Father Charbonneau, who they had worked with. And he's an amazing man for a few reasons, and one of which, not just because he's intelligent and a nice guy and everything, which is wonderful enough, but nobody can understand how he got away with doing paranormal investigation as a priest, being so vocal about it. He would tell any newspaper who would listen exactly what happened in that house and why it's real. So, and we just couldn't understand how he got everybody. When anybody I interviewed would say, oh, yeah, Father Charbonneau, yeah, we never could figure out how he can get away with that.
Well, he must have been so shocked, though, that this, I mean, to view this kind of activity. I mean, no one has seen this kind of stuff, you know. It's not in our normal day.
Right.
Oh, had he investigated other houses that were similar?
Father Charbonneau, I don't know about poltergeist cases, but other paranormal phenomena, yes. Ed and Lorraine Warren had worked with him, you know, on some cases. But, yeah, nobody really could figure out how he was, like I say, he would be in all the newspapers at the time saying what happened. Whereas Father Doyle, he towed the party line saying we can't assume anything. But behind the scenes, he did continue to help the family and, you know, console them and things like that, which was, you know, so he knew it was real. And it's funny because all the witnesses would mention his name, and Father Doyle said this, Father Doyle said that. Meanwhile, if you just read the newspapers, it would give you the impression that Father Doyle was over once and never saw him again. but he was very instrumental in, you know, bringing the family some peace during that hectic time.
Wow.
You know, during the 70s, there weren't too many paranormal investigators, as many as there are now. But did any paranormal investigators come in and check it all out and try to help them?
There were, besides the Warrens, who also brought Paulino, who ended up investigating the paranormal for some 40 years now. But at that time, this was his first major run-in with, you know, with these entities. And he was a 21-year-old seminary student at the time. But there were a few other people who showed up, and they were told, you know, we're all set. You know, the family wasn't going to let everybody in. You know, they did end up letting the Warrens in because their friends knew who they were. They didn't, the Goodens didn't know who the Warrens were. But, you know, everybody else had been at the house, and they figured, why not? And because their friends knew them, then they said, all right, well, you know, let's let them in and see what they could. They can't do any worse than the police and the firemen and everybody else.
Yeah, did any psychics show up on this case?
I think there was somebody who tried to get in, but they weren't let in. So there were a few people that, you know, were there, showed up or offered help, but, you know, they were told that we're all set. And they, because they had the Warrens there, Father Charbonneau and Paulino, so, you know, they had four people in the house helping at that point. And, you know, the Jerry's brothers a lot of times was outside the house and would turn people away. So, but I do know, I forget the names, but there was a few people that contacted me that said, yeah, we were there, we tried to help, but we were told that they were, you know, they were all set, they had enough people, you know, in the house.
Well, did they end up moving because of all of this?
They tried to sell the house and were unable to, even though the phenomena had stopped. What happened when Marcy ended up getting settled back, because she wasn't going to go back to the public school, the family, of course, wasn't going to send her back to the same environment where she was beat up. So Father Doyle helped them get a scholarship to get her into St. Patrick's School. And so once she got into school and was back into a routine, and, you know, the family was much more at peace, it dissipated. And so the phenomena was gone, but they still wanted out because, as Jerry said, you know, we can't live here. I can't work in this town. We don't want Marcy to have to grow up with the stigma. So they really wanted to get out of town, but they couldn't sell the house, probably for probably two main reasons. Probably didn't. It might have had something to do with the activity, but I think the bigger reasons were it was a really tiny house. I mean, it was 738 square feet. This was a tiny little bungalow. It was actually only three rooms, and Jerry made a bedroom out of the closet in the master bedroom for Marcy. So this was a really tiny house. And then the other thing is they wanted $31,000 for it because of the loans and things that they had on the house. So with those two factors together, it was tough to sell the house. And then, of course, you add on to that, you know, the other stuff that happened there, you know, today that probably would help sell it, but I'm not sure what it did then. But even without that, it would have been a tough house to sell, I think. And so because they couldn't sell it and because the phenomena had stopped by then, they decided to paint the house and get rid of these swan planters that were on the porch that they would move by themselves. So they were pretty infamous on their own. So they got rid of those, painted the house, trying to kind of hide where the house is so, you know, the gawkers wouldn't come by anymore. But instead it ended up in the paper, you know, new look on Lindley Street. So that idea. So
so one of the reviews said that that I read on your book, the lady said the only thing that didn't move in the house was the picture of the Last Supper. And she thought that was...
Oh,
something in it.
Yeah, there was, I mean, there were other things that didn't move in the house, and I think this comes to a lot of our assumptions, too. You know, that we see things through, of course, our beliefs and our own prejudices. And I'll give you an example in the case. If you ask some of the witnesses, you know, what items moved the most, they probably would, and a few did, say religious items. However, if you look at the data, if you actually look at the incident data that the investigators put together, which, you know, Boyce Beatty and his team from Duke University did an amazing job. It's very rare to have this many witnesses and this kind of documentation because they got there right away. But, at the incidents themselves, religious items were only impacted 10% of the time. 90% of the time, it was non-religious objects. So, but to the witnesses, they would remember and recall and remark about religious items. And I think the reason is it's a little more jarring to see, you know, a cross float down or shatter or something like that happen versus seeing a kitchen table lift up and flip. You know, there's kind of a different connotation to it. You know, it's a little more jarring, yeah. You know.
Yeah, definitely. How did you go about bringing the people together so that you could interview with them? How did you connect with these people?
Most of it was by phone, and social media was incredibly useful because everybody kind of, I don't want to say everybody, but so many people just came forward and said, oh, you know, you need to talk to this person, or I know where this person is. You know, I can contact them for you. Or did you talk to John yet? Because he was, you know, in the crowd. You know, and everybody, it was kind of like 6 degrees of Lindley Street. You know, everybody had a piece to it. And so that definitely helped locate people, locate additional people that, you know, newspapers never mentioned. And, you know, there was just, of course, so many people involved in this. Additional police officers and things like that. So that really opened up the investigation and made it just a lot easier for me because I was able to concentrate more and more on interviewing because there was a lot of time, of course, spent just trying to get out and find and reach people. But then it kind of got legs of its own where people were coming to me and helping me locate people, some of which I knew, some of which I didn't, and it really started to have legs and connect. The other thing is, of course, from the very beginning, once I found Boyce Beatty's name in the newspaper, and I ended up getting in touch with him and asking, you know, I heard that there was this big investigation. Do you have access to it? And he says, I think so. It's in a box in my basement. So he had 30 hours of interviews that he gave me and all the paperwork on it.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that was about half of, you know, the investigation. And then what I did is I reconnected with any of those people who are still with us that I could locate as along with doing another 10, 15 hours interviews on my own with, you know, additional witnesses, some of which had some really new and expansive information, and others that just had, you know, just a little bit of detail that enabled me to go back and add a little more texture to the story by putting in a detail or two that, you know, wasn't major but kind of made the scene come alive, you know.
I can imagine receiving this big box of goodies going, holy smokes.
Oh, I'll tell you, it was very exciting.
Like Christmas.
And,
it was.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it's Christmas time.
Yeah, he invited me over to his house, and he gave me a slideshow and he gave me a report he did, which now is in the book, but he did a preliminary report, and he got the newspaper and sat down. He said, here's a report. Read through it. It's my synopsis, and then we'll talk. And so I read it. He read the newspaper, and then we got together, and I asked him a million questions, and then we tested the tapes because, you know, they haven't been played in 40 years, and he gave me it all to me. And it was just really great to be able to put this work together and have him look at me and said, I can't believe how much you got of this story, because he says, you know more about this than I ever uncovered at the time. And I said, oh my God, boys, I mean, you interviewed so many people were interviewed and stuff. I couldn't have did it without him. It would have been, you know, well, for one thing, most of those people aren't with us, but it would have just been, it was a monster project as it is, but it would have been just unbelievable without, you know, the 30-hour head start. I mean, there was a reel-to-reel of 8 hours of police officer interviews that took place at the police station in a special conference room that was set up. I mean, the police mandated that their people be interviewed. So, I mean, they knew it wasn't a hoax. They actually actively and enthusiastically participated in the investigation and mandated that the police officers go in and be interviewed.
Well, out of all the interviews, was there anything that was particularly, like, stunned you or shocked you more than most of the interviews? I mean, there was one thing that stood out more than any other thing?
Yes. Yeah, a few things. And they were, and you know, I was glad I contacted. I almost wasn't going to be as diligent in contacting people who were already interviewed back in 1974 or 1975. But I'm glad I did, because some of them did not tell everything. There were things that they withheld because, you know, ridicule, or like in a police officer's case, his career. Even though they were private interviews that, you know, they were told this wasn't going to get out to anybody, you know, you still feel a little funny about it. And one of them... Yeah, I mean, one of them was Paul Eno, who was 21 at the time, when he had Marcy in back of him, and he, there was these four entities in front of him. They described him like gauzy-like figures, and one of them was trying to get around Paul, and he put his hand out, and he felt that the thing had substance, that it wasn't like...
Wow.
Yeah, and that's one of them. He described it as... He said, you know, I'm not a biologist, but actually, I'm going to play you his words. How's that? That would be
That would be much cooler.
Yeah, it's very short, but I'm going to play you his words. I got a few snippets here. Here we go.
I didn't know how people would take it. These things are supposed to be spirits, but they believe they were demons. But the demons have anatomy with no receptors. I mean, I'm not the biologist. I couldn't really identify them. Like a bird like. The thing got about me, and, you know, from the kid across the world.
So that's Paul describing. He said it felt like this bony, bird-like kind of structure. And he hadn't talked about it for 35 years. He was afraid what people would think. And he said he dare not tell Ed and Lorraine Warren, because these things were supposed to be demons. And you know, he was 21 years old. He said he wasn't going to tell them what he felt. You know, they would have thought he was crazy.
Yeah, another 21 years of exile.
Right.
So the Warrens came in to help. Did they suggest anything, or have the family do anything special to rid themselves?
Their big recommendation was if something happens in one room, get up and leave the room, go in a different room. And leave everything where it is. Because they wanted to, you know, record it. The Warrens were there, excuse me, with Paul Eno and Father Charbonneau for on and off, but mostly on for a lot of hours during the two days of intense activity. But once the hoax story was given to the public, they weren't allowed back. So everybody kind of got kicked off the case, if you will. So the phenomena continued. but there was no the next people that came in to help were was Boyce Beatty and the two guys from Duke University, Jerry Sulfin and Keith Harari, Bill Roll, who you may know, you know, probably the Poltergeist guy, at least at the time. He was in England at the time, so Keith and Jerry came. So the three of them were the next people to come in and help the family. Father Charbonneau did provide more support later on, and Father Doyle continued to supply continued to help them and you know, be a source of comfort and guidance through it. But so it kind of had multiple phases, if you will. That's what's interesting about this. Nobody really has the whole story. I mean, the Warrens have a piece of the story, but there was a lot that happened before and afterwards. And that was the same with basically everybody. So it was very satisfying to be able to gain new information from a witness and also be able to answer their questions that have lingered for 40 years of how their piece fit into the whole. You know, like Officer Joe Tomic was interviewed and was forced to be interviewed at the police department, but he didn't know why and by whom. So I was able to answer that for him while he was able to share insights and details that he didn't share back in 74 and expand upon it. And actually, he helped edit the chapter of what happened when he was there in the house. So, I mean, to have that kind of involvement from such credible witnesses was really great. Because, you know, it was like a soap opera. People don't know you're writing a book, so you've got to get a timeline together because they're jumping days and everything. So you have to make sure, you know, everything is there and, you know. But, yeah, you know, so if you ever anybody ever interviews you about paranormal phenomena, assume they're writing a book and give lots of details.
How long did this take you to from the beginning to the end?
It took me probably about 8-9 months. It would have taken longer, but, you know, I had a deadline. But what really helped was I kind of ran on two tracks with it. With the initial interviews, once I had a timeline done, I began writing it. But I kept interviewing while I was writing. So, you know, there was the writing piece, and then they continued. I mean, I was interviewing right up until, you know, I submitted the manuscript. And sometimes I'd find out one little extra detail. Oh, they threw garlic at the house. Oh, that's neat. All right, let me go back and, you know, add that into the, you know, the crowd area, if there was something specific or new detail that came in, I would go back and, you know, rewrite or add on as needed. But I kept interviewing, you know, because people would be found, or other people would say, hey, did you know this person did this, or, you know, that kind of thing. And so as you come across new people, you don't want to not interview them. You want to make, you know, you're always, of course, with this kind of thing, you're always afraid somebody's going to come forth with new information after you hand the thing in. But
even the whole town has something fresh and new that they might not have heard. This book
right.
is open. You know, it's beautiful. Let me ask you a question. There, in chapter 10, you say an extraordinary game of checkers. What was that? I didn't get to find out.
Oh, well, a police officer is there inside the house, and this is after it was declared a hoax. I mean, which is another kind of neat part to the case is, you know, they announced it a hoax, but the police department is still providing protection to the family. Not just outside crowd control, but inside the house. So, you know, that was interesting. But so there was a police officer inside the house at the time, and Marcy wanted to play checkers, and they played checkers, and she lost, and she accused the officer. She said, "Oh, I think he cheated," and And as she, you know, she went to her room, three things fell over at once. Beer fell, and all of this happened while she was in full view with the, you know, the checker box, you know, in her hands. And so that, you know, and of course that people would say was, you know, that's psychokinetic or whatever, but I don't know. We know there definitely is a relationship between whatever was there and Marcy, and we know that Marcy was the center of it. But, yeah, that was an interesting bit of phenomena that the police officer saw. And they actually, after that, the family actually ended up leaving the house that day because of the phenomena that happened. They asked the police officer, what should we do and stuff. And he said, you may want to go stay with family now, too. So they all left.
Yeah, oh my God.
And that was
how are you going to get sleep after going through some of these stories and writing about them? Do they kind of tickle your brain when you're trying to rest?
No, not in a bad way. Definitely a fascination, you know, an ongoing fascination and questioning and wanting to know more.
Yeah.
And of course, that's how it did expand into a book, you know, to know more, but it was quite fascinating.
Did you interview anybody that was scared of the whole thing? I mean, like a neighbor or somebody who was frightened, and they were one of the people that threw the garlic, or did you interview anyone like that?
No, nobody identified. I wasn't able to identify a particular person who did an act like that, if that's what you mean. But what was amazing is some of the lectures that I did, and, you know, one of them in Milford, which is close to Bridgeport, Connecticut. But I'm amazed at how many witnesses show up, or children of witnesses. You know, one lady showed up and said, yeah, I live two houses down, and I heard the screams. And another lady said, my dad was, you know, firemen there, and you know, just everybody had a story or, you know, a relation in some way to it. That, you know, a lot of people that grew up in Bridgeport, they really never knew what happened, but it impacted just so many people because it was so public. It just you know, these things normally don't get that public. Some of them get, you know, public to degree, but this was crazy with over 2,000 people outside the house. So it really ended up getting a lot of people that were connected to it somehow. And of course, when you have, you know, 16 or more police officers involved, even the police officers who weren't directly there seeing things, I mean, they have friends. And the officers have friends. And, you know, so when you add in all of these, you know, over 100 witnesses and everybody they know, you know, the thing just really, it's got a lot of legs to it. And there's just a lot of stories and experiences with people. You know, I even interviewed a guy who dated the superintendent's daughter. You know, so you had all sorts of connections that you interview, what was going on behind the scenes, what the children heard at home, you know, when their dad got home from dealing with this case and racking their brain on trying to, you know, close the case and get the people to go home. And, you know, so you had family involvement and, you know, their perspective too. So
how large is that town? It doesn't sound very big. How large is it?
Bridgeport?
Uh-huh.
It's a pretty decent sized city. It's
oh,
not
okay.
I mean, the house is tiny, but it was like two blocks from the hospital, so it was right in the middle of the city. And yeah, I mean, I'd have to Google to find out exactly how much because I'm bad with that. But it's not, you know, a tiny little area, you know. Yeah, that was right downtown in a kind of a lower income part of Bridgeport. The 2,000 people outside is not a good, that's not a good judge because people, of course, started coming from all over, so it's hard to really
tell.
Yeah,
really.
Well, you know what the story is in the house at night when after people look at that, that's all they could talk about probably.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bill, let us give out your website. We're getting toward the end here, and it's the name of your book, worldsmosthauntedhouse.com, and that's your website. Is there anything else that we haven't touched upon that you would like to share with us?
Well, I'd like to say at worldsmosthauntedhouse.com, there are some free things that you can get, so check it out. Hopefully, you'll like the site. And also, it has an event calendar of other great interviews, probably not as good as this one, of course, but, you know, with such lovely interviewers, but there are others, and where I'm going to be for those that are local or somewhat local. And there's just so much to this case, but I would say I'd like to sum it up that if you have an open mind or even if you already believe in all of this, if there's somebody that you really, if you want to take a book and say, you know, I want one book that's going to give me the proof that I need, I'm not trying to be, conceited when I say it, but I believe this case is the one that would do it. I mean, it's the one that did it for me. Unless, of course, 100 witnesses is not worth it. Obviously, if you don't care what any witnesses say or police reports say or anything like that, then, of course, we all know for some things nothing is going to convince you. But I think this is a case that is a great one to share with people who are open-minded but very skeptical. Because I'm that way too, and you should be. Obviously, if you
have
know
you been
somebody,
offered
around,
any movie rights?
You have an offer?
Yeah.
No.
No, I was thinking
it'd make
an excellent movie.
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I really would love that, and so would my creditors. But no, but no, I really would, and it would be nice if they did it in an accurate manner too. Would be very pleasant. I think it's a great enough story with plenty of phenomena that you really don't have to do an Amityville on it. In other words,
bump it up. This is really. One guy says if you want to sleep, make sure you don't read this story before you go to bed.
Yeah, Dr. Andrew Nichols said that. And
Oh, my God.
I came out, I was telling everybody I knew it wasn't scary, but then I got in trouble, so I stopped saying anything. I said, I don't know, you read it yourself.
Well, we want everybody to know if they want to go out. I mean, go on to Amazon.com to buy the book. That the author's name, Bill's name, is William J. Hall. So it might be easier to find it because we've been calling you Bill for the hour. So people should look under William J. Hall.
Yes. And the name of the book is, let's see, oh my God.
That's all right.
The World's Most Haunted House. The True Story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Lindley Street. And this is it's an honor having you with us today, Bill. Thank you for sharing your time with us and wrapping up one of the scariest times for many into a book. And, and it's true. I mean, it's like we, people really live this story. And, like I say, Halloween is not one of my favorite times.
It's my favorite time. So.
I know it's Paula's favorite.
Well, that's why you two work good together. See, you got both sides covered. thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you
have
so
a blessed
much.
Day.
It was a great interview. Bye-bye.
Bye.
An African Jamal Davis. That gentleman is going to bring you all the goodies this time. Okay, and have a terrific week.
When you don't go to geico.com, car insurance can be hard. Like early 90s heavy metal hard.
I'm yelling!
Geico makes it easy. You can review and update your policy or report a claim on Geico.com or the Geico mobile app. Because shouldn't we all have a little less stress in our lives?
I'm not even upset about anything!
Calling all shoppers. This is one event you can't afford to miss. Kohl's 50% off sale this Thursday through Saturday. Take 50% off hundreds of items store-wide. Plus, take an extra 20% off. Plus, take an extra $10 off your purchase of $50 or more. Plus, everyone gets Kohl's cash. Plus, Yes to You members earn triple points. Now that's the good stuff. Kohl's. Select styles offer valid 10/27 through 10/30. Some exclusions apply. See store or kohls.com for details.